and flood flashlights. Another smash at the chair. Suddenly, the glass shattered all at once. The five of us took off running, whooping, and shouting at the top of our lungs, out into the night, exploding past the officers, their flashlights blinding us.
"Police! We command you to freeze!"
"Warriors!" whooped Kipling.
"Go to hell and back again!"
Somewhere behind me, Kip was howling. Whitley, too. Cannon was singing. I ran blindly, weird, strung-out laughter hiccuping out of me as I willed the dark to swallow me. I could see one of the officers drawing his gun. I half expected him to shoot me out of sheer terror, thinking this was the beginning of some zombie apocalypse. I headed for the darkest part of the field, forcing my legs to go faster and faster, lungs tightening in pain, rain pummeling me. When I glanced back, I could see flashing red and blue police lights, figures swarming the aquatic center. No one had followed me. I was alone. I slowed to a jog, then a walk, rain needling my face. I realized I had reached the edge of the woods. I crossed onto a hiking trail and headed down it. Soon my mind quieted and I was aware only of my footsteps in the mud. It was everywhere, gelatinous and black as tar. Jim. It was so dark I could almost feel him here, strolling beside me. I wanted so badly to scream at him, to demand the truth. Why so many secrets? Jim was the painting I'd always thought was a one-of-a-kind masterpiece. As it turned out, there were countless versions of the same work floating around, smaller watercolors and rudimentary pencil sketches, cheap poster reprints selling for 99 cents in an airport gift shop. True, none of them had the beauty and detail of my painting, but they still depicted the same scene and thus rendered it a little less special. Vita had her version, Mr. Joshua his, Whitley hers. Even Martha. There had been something disconcerting about the way she'd announced it. I had Jim's guitar. Her feelings for Jim seemed to rise to the surface strong and strange, barely controlled, before sinking back into the depths. The rain fell harder, thunder growling. I walked on. Now and then, with a wave of revulsion, I swore I caught a glimpse of the keeper, dressed in his gardener's slicker, hiking between the trees. But every time I stopped, my heart pounding, staring into the woods to be sure. There was no one. Soon I could feel the leaden pull of the Neverworld taking hold, the now familiar tingling grip starting at my feet, crawling up my shins. The path had taken me to a clearing where there was strong wind and giant fallen trees all over the ground. Squinting, I saw a hulking oak teetering a few yards in front of me. Suddenly, it fell with a deafening crack, the entire forest echoing with the sound. I froze in alarm. Another crack rang out right beside me. Turning, I realized it was another oak coming loose. I tried to move out of the way, only to realize my feet were stuck in the cement-like mud. I managed to wrench them free, blindly throwing myself forward as the tree thundered to the ground, missing me by inches, branches shaking and snapping, whipping my head. What was happening? I lifted my head and crawled away, tried to take another step but fell face down in the mud. The Neverworld blackout was descending. The end of the 11.2 hours had come. I managed to roll onto my back, gasping as I blinked up at the sky, the rain. It felt like being buried alive under the weight of a million poured coins, my body sinking deeper and deeper into mud. Soon I would feel my limbs breaking apart and dissolving. Another tree began to tear loose a few feet away. My final thought was panic. Panic that I was going to die here with no solution to the mystery. The confessions of Vita, Joshua, and Whitley had solved nothing. Would I ever know what really had happened to Jim? How could I win the vote and get back to life? At that moment, I realized a dark figure was standing over me with a cruel expression. The Keeper. "In the dark there grows a tree, A castle tower shelters thee. When will I stop? When will I see? There is no poison but for me. I screamed as the oak tree fell on top of me, and everything went black. Chapter 13. I woke up, gasping in the back seat of the Jaguar, Martha and Kip beside me. My heart was still pounding from the massive tree collapsing on me, the swamp-like mud, the sudden appearance of the Keeper, the insidious rhyme he'd recited. I felt nauseous, but there was no time to think. Martha and Kipling were scrambling out of the car, running toward the house. I took off after them. Like me, they seemed worried that Whitley wouldn't be there anymore, that, humiliated by the revelation that she had long been the White Rabbit, maybe even scared that we'd hold her accountable for Jim's death, she'd fled. Instead, we found her sitting with Cannon in the kitchen. I could see from their mutually subdued demeanors that they'd been having an intense conversation, perhaps even arguing. Whitley looked red-faced and sullen. There was a hint of relief on her face. "Whitley has something to tell you," announced Cannon. She glanced up with a feeble smile. "I'm sorry. I'm sorry for what I did to Jim. To the other students. For lying to all of you. It was disgusting and stupid. It could have ruined my life. It almost did. But I swear with every fiber of my being I had nothing to do with Jim's death. I understand you might not believe me now. But we will find out what happened to him that night, and you'll know I'm innocent." Kipling and Martha, studying her, seemed to accept this. They nodded. I nodded too. And yet, considering she'd lied to us for so long, I had to remind myself Whit was still capable of lying. Though I couldn't imagine her plotting to harm Jim, I also couldn't ignore what she was capable of in a rage, or the fact that she now had a motive. If Whitley had believed that Jim was going to expose her secret, that the administration and, most seriously of all, the Linda, were going to find out the terrible things she'd been doing, it wasn't outrageous to think she would have done anything to prevent that from happening. Abruptly, I was aware of everyone staring at me. "What?" I blurted. "We were wondering what you thought of Vita's confession," said Martha. I shrugged. "I think I believe her."
"Me too," said Kipling with a wry smile. "A girl like Vita can't lie very well. How many times did she call Jim a genius? I'm surprised she didn't suggest he'd risen from the dead like Jesus."
He looked at me. "You know I loved Jim to pieces, but the way he collected admirers could get a little old. His ego, bless his soul, could be an insatiable baby."
"He didn't do it on purpose," I said. "People were drawn to him."
"Didn't do it on purpose," said Kipling. "Sure. That's like me holding up an iron rod in a football field during a storm and saying it's not my fault I got struck by lightning."
"She was especially impressed by Jim's lyrics for his musical," said Martha.
"Right. The sudden blast of brilliance. That was something. Remember how he had nothing written for weeks except a few bad rhymes straight out of MC Hammer? He kept complaining that he was finished, dried up, torturing us all pretty much. Then, out of the blue, a masterpiece."
Kipling waved his hand in the air, a drowsy gesture.
"Strands of lyrics like pearls, one after the other. All about the immense pain of being young and alive."
"Those lyrics were amazing," said Whitley.
"The performance at Spring Vespers was a hit," said Cannon thoughtfully, interlacing his fingers. "The New York producer, Mr. Joshua, arranged, loved the demo. Jim's destiny was teed up, on the brink, like he always wanted. So what happened?"
"Life," said Kipling dryly.
"Or," said Martha,
It had something to do with that ride from Vita Joshua. She gnawed a thumbnail. I'm wondering if we can track down that shopping center.
All Vita gave us to go on was a pet store and a fast food restaurant, said Whit.
When was the last time you talked to Jim? Martha asked me suddenly, squinting.
Tuesday afternoon. I cleared my throat. The second night of Vespers, I confronted him about lying to me about the infirmary.
So you didn't speak to Jim at all the next day, the day he died?
I shook my head. No one said anything, all of them doubtlessly thinking how tragic it must have been for me, for that argument about Vita Joshua to be our last conversation. The truth was, Wednesday I'd exiled myself to Marksman Library, hiding out in the fourth-floor attic stacks in the History of South America section, which was seldom visited by students. It reeked of mildew and served as a shadowy breeding ground for a range of freakishly large moths. All day I sat hunched over my European history and English literature textbooks in front of the lone window with the dirty glass, Beats headphones blasting the soundtrack to Suicide Squad in my ears, forcing myself to focus on the French Revolution and World War II and For Whom the Bell Tolls. I kept my cell phone off all day because I didn't want to deal with Jim. The only time I exposed myself to the rest of campus was during my 4-minute walk between the library and my room in Creston Hall around 11 o'clock. I waited until I'd put on my pajamas and climbed into bed at midnight before turning on my cell, whereupon I was hit by the torrent of texts. A few were from Kipling, Cannon, and Whit. 27 others were from Jim. They'd started at 8 that morning, messages ranging from question mark to come on to why are you being like this to desperate voicemails, his mood ranging from teasing to despair to anger, all of which sounded crazy and heartbreaking the more I replayed them.
Call me. Call me Bumblebee. We need to talk. If you have any love left in your heart, call me. Why are you doing this? I need you. You know how I need you to survive. I hate you. I hate you so much because I love you. Don't do this. I'm going to the quarry. Meet me.
That was the last text I ever got from him. Received at 11:29 p.m. I deleted it. I deleted all of them. When they found Jim dead 2 days later, I expected the police to ask me about his texts. I'd tell them I had remained in my room all night. But they never did ask. No one ever even questioned me. I was tempted to tell them that I knew Jim was going to Vulcan Quarry, but what if they didn't believe I'd stayed in my dorm all night? I'd be damned to the Neverworld forever. I'd have no chance, none, of ever making it out of here alive.
What if we went to the police now? Whispered Cannon.
What? Asked Whitley.
What if we went to speak to the Warwick police about Jim? We could get our hands on his case file. They have to have pulled his cell phone records. We get our hands on those reports. We'll know a lot about his final days, where he went and who he was with.
The police never came up with anything substantial to make them think Jim's death was anything but suicide, said Martha.
Unless the school forced them to cover up what they found, said Whitley.
Or his family, added Kipling. If Edgar Mason thought something damning was about to come out about his beloved dead son, the apple of his eye, he'd do anything to stop it from getting out. Remember the safe house?
We said nothing, all of us thinking back. Christmas break, senior year, Jim invited us to his family home in Watermill, and we were shocked by the extreme security measures his family had adopted as totally routine. Edgar Mason had always been paranoid. Hoover, Jim called his dad, a not exactly joking reference to J. Edgar Hoover, the fanatical wiretapping founder of the FBI. For years, Edgar Mason had employed a private security firm called Torchlight
to safeguard his family, which meant for the entirety of Jim's life, two armed ex-Navy SEALs silently tailed him and every other member of his family when they left the house. The Christmas visit revealed a new level of Edgar's obsession. Every inch of the Masons' many houses around the world was being recorded in HD, the feeds playing in a basement control room called the Eye. There was a cybersecurity team on staff in Washington, D.C., who monitored the family's servers 24 hours a day. Then there was the safe house. "For home invasions, terrorist attacks, and 0 days," Jim said, pointing out the black bunker peering out, crocodile-like, over the hill on the edge of the property. "It has power generators, independent water supplies, a secure phone line that can call the director of Homeland Security in 3 seconds. When the end of the world happens, let's meet here." The smile fell from his face, the lonely implications of such a structure hardly lost on him. He seemed reluctant to say more. After all, his dad's obsession with safety had everything to do with him. Edgar Mason had always been careful, but it was apparently Jim's boating accident the summer before senior year that had triggered this new level of mania. "I say we go over there," said Cannon. "Ask around. See what the police know." "Or are trying to forget," said Whitley. "B?" prompted Martha. Everyone turned, waiting for me to weigh in. I stared back. Taking a look inside Jim's police file could mean his final texts to me would come to light. I'd have a lot to explain. But what else was in that file? The decision was really no decision at all. Chapter 14.
"Can I help you?" asked the police officer.
Polk read his name tag.
"We'd like to speak to Detective Calhoun," Whitley said sweetly.
Calhoun had been the lead investigator on Jim's case. He'd given the few public statements and briefings. We had decided it was easy enough to start with him, with his thick gray beard and rodent eyes, his wan blinks at the news cameras as a gaudy rash of embarrassment seeped across his neck. One sensed he wanted nothing more than to get away from the glare of such a high-profile case and go back to working petty crimes like public bench vandalism.
"What do you want with Calhoun?"
demanded another officer, now approaching. His name tag read McAndrus.
"We wanted to ask him about a case he worked on," said Martha.
"Which one?"
"The death of Jim Mason," I said.
"That case is closed," said a third officer.
After 10 more minutes of hostile questioning, they seemed wary of outsiders. We made it to Calhoun's office, finding the man in question marooned behind a desk piled high with papers, like a giant bullfrog hiding in a bog. I wasn't sure what I expected. Maybe that movie scene where the grizzled old detective asked about the cold case still haunting him after all these years begins to talk and talk. Instead, Detective Calhoun was a concrete wall.
"Mason case was solved. Suicide," he belched.
"What made you rule suicide?" Martha asked, frowning. "Usually with suicides, there's a ritual or preparation before the act. A note left behind. Glasses removed, as well as shoes and socks. Was there any sign of that with Jim?" Calhoun flashed a grin that was really more of a sneer.
"That case is closed."
That case is closed. The Warwick police station, located just off the highway, was a quaint banana-yellow bungalow with white shutters and a sign on the bulletin board that read, "Life is better with coffee." The place seemed ill-suited for solving crimes, better for selling homemade muffins. Little did we know how terrifying it would be that our time with the Warwick police would be pandemonium. There was no other way to put it. We tried different tactics. Warm, curt, nervous, sexy. Whit, wearing a low-cut red dress, perched on a desk. We tried surprising them. We tried a brazen arrival at Calhoun's private residence after his wife went to bed and Calhoun stayed up late drinking Harpoon IPA, eating gummy worms, and watching Better Call Saul. No matter what we said, and where, how, or what time we said it, Calhoun refused to tell us anything about Jim's case.
Can't help you. You Nancy Drews, get out of here. How dare you accost me at my home? You kids get out of here, or I'll make sure every one of you spends the rest of your life flipping byproduct burgers at the local Mickey D's, because a fryolator and an automatic mixer to make a few watery milkshakes are all you'll be fit for after I get through with you. Understand me?
We decided to give up on Calhoun and bribe the office manager, Frederica. We waited for her to leave the station in workout clothes, watched her getting drenched in the downpour as her umbrella went inside out. As she fumbled for the keys to her Kia, Cannon ran to her, armed with a golf umbrella and a grin. We watched from the Mercedes as he made his pitch. $10,000 cash to go back inside and steal the Jim Mason file. Frederica blushed, nodded, and power walked back inside. Cannon turned, grinning, giving us the thumbs up. Then Frederica emerged with the entire Warwick police force in tow, 8 officers hightailing it for Cannon.
Get on your knees! Police!
With a yelp, Whitley backed the car out, tearing through the lot to pick up Cannon, who, sprinting for his life, hurled himself into the back seat. We barreled through the grass, over a curb, and through a red light into a 12-lane intersection, tires squealing, and nearly collided with a cement truck.
Move!
Cannon screamed.
Move!
We spent the next few weeks at Roscoe Gun Range learning how to shoot as we formulated our new plan. We would raid the Warwick police. We paid the owner of Last Resort 24-Hour Pawn Shop $50 for the name of a guy who sold guns without a license out of the back of his RV, called Big Bobby. Out of Big Bobby, we bought 3 guns, 2 Ruger LC-9 Strikers, and a Heckler & Koch HK-45. Our siege would take place at 11:15 when we believed all officers, apart from Polk and McAndrus, had gone home for the night. We'd take them by surprise and lock them in the supply closet. Then we'd have the station to ourselves, and we could find Jim's file. The first time we attempted it, Officer McAndrus, displaying moves apparently learned from a fruitful career moonlighting in mixed martial arts, struck Kip with an uppercut to the face, elbowed Wit in the ribs, then spinning, back-kicked Cannon's stomach, sending him gasping to the floor. Meanwhile, Officer Polk had me pinned to the ground, his left foot gouging my back as he zip-tied Martha to a desk chair.
"The Warwick police aren't actually police," said Kipling with unabashed wonder the next wake. "They're the spawn of Satan."
He wasn't kidding. How many times at midnight, at 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, did the 5 of us storm that station? Was it 100 times? Was it 10,000? How many different entry SWAT formations did we attempt after finding on the internet the Ground Reconnaissance Operations Handbook, a training manual for Marines? Single file, double file advancement with variation, through front doors, back doors, barred windows, fire escapes, drain pipes, adjacent building rooftops. We downloaded something called The Criminal's Guide to Revelry off the deep net, a hand-typed, poorly photocopied manual written by anonymous Doe that detailed strategies for nullifying people who were aggressive, hysterical, or empowered by Superman fantasies during any raid, heist, or robbery. How many terrifying masks did we try? Clown, pig, clockwork orange droogs? How many bullets did we shoot into the ceiling? How many threats and warnings did we scream? It should have been easy to get our hands on one case file. As the wakes went on, we transformed from disorganized teenagers acting out a makeshift version of Mission Impossible into a real 5-person platoon. We were able to advance without noise, reading each other's thoughts and movements with nothing but a look. Wake after wake, we were thwarted. This was not due to Officers Polk and McAndrus, but to their wild card, Officer Victoria Channing, assigned to traffic safety. She was always in the women's bathroom, and she advanced on us out of nowhere, displaying an eagerness to kill that was psychotic.
"Take that, you little shitheads!"
she screamed. She was terrifying, even if we were immortal. Though Cannon and Whitley had learned to nullify Polk and McAndrus, Channing eluded them every time. She was able to slip like vapor through the back stairwell, the front stairwell, a panel in the ceiling, firing her Glock without warning into Cannon's chest. Or Kip's stomach. Or Whitley's forehead. The time she shot Martha in the temple, as if blithely turning the knob on a gumball machine, I froze, stunned, staring down at her and the rest of my friends lying on the police station carpet, blood gurgling out of their foreheads and necks like water trickling from a hose.
"Hands up or you'll be joining them in hell!"
screeched Officer Channing, aiming at me. "Death feels like floating in a warm bath," said Martha the next wake. I was always the only one left alive. This was because I wasn't a natural warrior. I tended to freeze when I needed to act. As a result, Cannon had decided my job was to locate Jim's case file. Find Jim's file. It was all I had to do. The closed homicide cases were kept in the basement. It was an unnerving, neglected fish tank of a room, humming green fluorescent light, smells of mildew, pipes yowling with steam. Row after row of metal shelves extended, dreamlike in every direction, floor to ceiling, packed with cardboard boxes. Each box was scribbled with a victim's name. Appleton, Janice. Avery, Jennifer. Azella, Robert P. At every break-in, no matter the hell being unleashed upstairs, I headed straight to the back stairwell and raced to the basement. I'd fling open the wooden doors marked storage and sprint into the labyrinth of shelves, madly looking for the M's, my footsteps squeaking on the orange linoleum. Every time Channing caught me, and I spent the rest of the wake sitting in a jail cell hearing her tell the other officers a phony story about having to kill everyone else in self-defense. And yet, each wake, while my friends were dealing with the mayhem upstairs, I was dealing with my own torment in that droning green basement, a trial that had nothing to do with Officer Channing. It began when I accidentally kicked a box off a bottom shelf. Hendrews, Holly. The box tipped over, sending a plastic bag marked evidence spinning across the floor. Inside, there was a blood-encrusted Christmas scarf decorated with snowmen and reindeer. But what struck me, I stopped dead, blinking in alarm, was that the bag was spangled with black mildew. The box was also leaking. I kicked it closer, peering inside. An oil-like liquid had pooled in the corners, as if one of the evidence bags had leaked. Glancing up, I saw, stunned, that it wasn't just this box. There were others. At least four or five boxes had that same black liquid seeping through the bottom. Then there were the shelves. They were hulking in metal. Yet sometimes as I raced past them, madly searching for Mason Jim, the slightest brush of my shoulder would send the giant shelf toppling over as if it were nothing but cardboard. It would land with a deafening clang, sending the one beside it over, the one beside that too, until all the shelves in the basement were falling around me like massive dominoes, hundreds of boxes thundering to the ground. All I could do was scramble out of the way, press my back against the nearest wall, pray I didn't get hit until it was over. Afterward, I'd try to sift through the rubble for Jim's box before Officer Channing caught me red-handed, as she always did. I never mentioned to the others what was happening. I was too scared. "How's it going in the basement?" Cannon asked me. "Are you close to finding Jim's file? I heard a lot of banging downstairs this last time." "There's a lot to sift through," I said. "I'm close." The key, I'd found, was to sprint through the shelves as fast as I could, allowing them to fall after me as I kept running and running toward the row of M's at the very back of the basement. I had just perfected the optimal path through the maze when, once, barreling too fast, I missed the correct row and was forced to backtrack. I was careful not to graze the shelf as I made the turn and slowed to a walk, panting. Usually there was the sound of havoc upstairs, banging and screaming. This time, it was quiet. Too quiet. Machinsky, Tina D. Mahmoudi, Wafa. Malvo, Jed. I spotted Jim's box on the top shelf at the very end. In a rush of disbelief, I sprinted to it, reached on my tiptoes, tried to jostle it down without sending the entire shelf clattering over. Mason, Jim Livingston.
Gotcha, you little shit, a woman hissed.
Put your hands up and turn real slow.
Channing had stepped out from behind the shelves and was striding toward me. Glock aimed right at my head.
Don't shoot, please.
Her face was flushed. Her lips twitched. She pulled the trigger. She never had before. A giant match lit the wick of my brain. I hit the ground, rolling onto my back, accidentally throwing out my arms, which hit the shelf, sending it flying backward.
What the?
Channing screamed in shock. As the shelves fell, I blinked up at the fluorescent lights, green filaments flickering in mysterious Morse code. There was so much pain it spilled everywhere, then drifted away. Dying was not as cataclysmic as I thought it'd be. Because even though I was in the Neverworld, my body and mind still reacted as if it were the real thing. There was no white light. There was no tunnel. Instead, as the shelves tumbled around me, there was a warm feeling of awe, as if, with the tearing away of my life from its attachment to Earth, fragile as the connection of a leaf to a twig, everything permanent, factual, real, everything I swore was true, became the opposite of what I'd always thought. My last feeling wasn't regret or pain. It was joy. That was the most terrifying thing of all. I get to see Jim now. That was all I was thinking before my life went out. If I'm dead, I'll get to see Jim.
Really don't feel like getting shot in the head today, sang Kipling merrily as we filed into Wincroft at the start of the next wake. How about we take a page from Mama Greer's Guide to the Good Life? What's that? Asked Cannon. Can't beat your mortal enemy to a pulp, he shrugged. Throw him a party.
That was how we came to arrive at the Warwick police station armed not with our usual guns, but with identical Barry the Clown costumes rented from Gobbledygook Halloween World.
May I help you? Asked Frederica at the front desk. We're from Big Apple Balloonogram, I said, smiling. Where would you like us to set up for the surprise party?
What surprise party?
Detective Art Calhoun's surprise 70th.
Frederica was astonished. So were Officers Polk, McAndress, Cunningham, Leach, Ives, and Mapleton, as well as Art Calhoun himself, who emerged from his office with a distrustful scowl. But we had moved fast. The wireless speaker was already playing Margaritaville. Wit had already unveiled 36 cupcakes, baskets of gummy worms, and party favors of gun Christmas tree ornaments. Cannon and Kip were standing on folding chairs, taping up the tinsel happy birthday sign. Martha tossed bottles of Harpoon IPA into a cooler.
Hold up! Just wait one...
Calhoun fell silent, eyeing the beer.
What's happening here? Demanded Officer Polk.
I made an elaborate show of examining the phony invoice, which was really the receipt for our costume rentals.
Elizabeth Calhoun hired us, I said with a frown.
Lizzie did this?
Whispered Calhoun, wide-eyed. Liz Calhoun was his estranged daughter who lived in San Diego. She hadn't spoken to her father in 3 years, which meant there was little chance she'd take his call now when he phoned to thank her for the unexpected party, even though his real 70th birthday was over 3 weeks away. That meant I had time to find Jim's file.
Nothing better than cupcakes, said Officer Channing, grinning as she helped herself.
And now, friends, let's start the entertainment, shouted Kipling with a bow so low his red clown nose fell off and rolled under a desk. If you could all gather round and join hands, don't be shy.
That was my cue. I darted into the back stairwell. I raced down the steps to the basement, heaved open the wood doors, and sprinted into the shadowed rows of boxes. I raced along the back wall, slipping past filing cabinets and a copy machine, and veered into the G's, the J's, the L's, zigzagging in and out, careful not to graze the shelves, my oversized clown shoes making loud quacking noises, my balloon pants making me trip. Eighth row, far left, at the very top, Mason Jim Livingston. It was there. My heart pounding, I had to jump up 3 times to shove it off the shelf without sending the entire thing toppling over. I set it carefully on the ground. You found it? I turned, startled, to see Martha hurrying toward me. She'd never appeared down here before. The knowing, even anxious look on her face seemed to suggest she had come because she didn't trust me, because she didn't want me left alone with the box. Or was it that she'd hoped I would never actually find it? I ripped off the tape and pulled open the lid. I stared inside for an entire minute, unable to speak. No. No. No, impossible. Are you kidding me? Whispered Martha in apparent shock, looking over my shoulder. After all that? Getting shot dead 1,000,000 times? Shaking her head, a hand on her hip, she took down another box. Maybe Jim's file got put somewhere else, she muttered. I couldn't stop staring in, unable to breathe. The box was empty. There wasn't a single paper left except a coupon. $5 off 1 bin of Honey Love fried chicken. Soulmate special. Upstairs, more singing and clapping had broken out. For he's a jolly good fellow. Martha was madly thrusting more boxes to the floor, yanking off the lids. Every one was crammed full of papers, plastic evidence bags, black ink. That ink was back, seeping through the corners again. How can anyone find anything in here? It's a mess. There's some kind of leak. Martha was examining the ink between her fingers, wrinkling her nose, though when she caught my eye, the knowing expression on her face chilled me. We spent another 10 minutes going through boxes, Martha saying, "It has to be here somewhere." The only empty box we came across was Jim's. Martha knew something. That was clear. What it was, I had no idea. Chapter 15. Edgar Mason and Torchlight Security are behind it, said Cannon when we were back at Wincroft, sprawled across the couches in the library. Who else could make an entire case file just vanish? They had everything destroyed, said Kipling in agreement. Which was why Calhoun and the other cops were always so touchy when we asked about the case. They've been paid off. But why? I asked.
Don't you see? Said Cannon. Something in there was incriminating to Jim.
Right, said Witt with a nod. They didn't want it made public, so they sent some Torchlight ex-Navy SEAL into the station and he stole it.
Which means the Masons know the truth, said Kipling. And, Cannon continued, if they haven't come forward to arrest anyone, if they've stayed silent, it means whatever they uncovered was damaging for the family.
As everyone fell silent, considering all this, my eyes caught Martha's. She seemed skeptical, or her mind was somewhere else. I'd been unable to stop thinking about her sudden appearance in the basement and the look on her face when she'd spotted the ink. It made me wonder whether she suspected me somehow, whether she knew I'd received those texts from Jim asking me to meet him that night at the quarry. Out of all of us, B, she said suddenly. You spent the most time with the Masons. Did they ever tell you what they thought happened to their son?
I shook my head, shrugging.
We completely fell out of touch. Countless times during the past year, I'd wondered how the Masons had handled Jim's death. I never found out. I never even made it to Jim's funeral. My parents, fretting about my mental well-being, begged me not to go. And while a few Darrow students, including Whitley, Cannon, and Kip, had gotten special permission to take the train to New York for the service, I decided to stay away. My absence, I knew, would come as a relief. His family had liked their modern art collection infinitely more than they'd ever liked me. Jim's mom, Gloria, a champagne flute of a woman, all ice blonde hair and long limbs with a low voice, always surveyed me as if I were a window with an airshaft view. Jim's father had to be introduced to me 3 times before he recalled who I was. And even then, he called me Barbara.
I say we pay a surprise visit to the Masons, said Whitley.
We'll probably have to waterboard him to get him to talk, child, said Kipling. But count me in.
There's a problem, I said.
What? Asked Martha.
The wake.
What about it?
It's only 11.2 hours. That's not enough time.
What do you mean? Asked Kip, frowning. We fly to East Hampton. We'll be outside the Masons' Watermill estate in less than 2 hours.
They're not in Watermill. The Masons spend every summer on Amorgos, an island in the Aegean Sea. It takes 11 hours by plane, plus a 3-hour boat ride. Then you have to hike up a mountain to reach the house.
They seemed skeptical, so I dialed the Masons' Fifth Avenue apartment. The housekeeper who answered confirmed the family was away.
Are they at Villa Anna Sophia on Amorgos Island? I asked. That's right. Would you like to leave a message for Mr. and Mrs. Mason?
Jim called his family's compound in Greece the milkshake for the way it oozed down the cliff overlooking the ocean. Much to my parents' irritation, I'd spent 5 days there with Jim the summer before junior year. Although the time had passed in a sunburnt blur of bleached white beaches and outdoor feasts, sunset boat rides, and Greek folk music, Jim working relentlessly on his musical, that island and the Masons' vertigo-inducing compound remained one of the most surreally beautiful places I'd ever seen.
We could try Skyping them, suggested Kipling. Hi, we're Jim's old friends phoning from Purgatory. We command you to tell us everything about your son's death.
I guess that's that, said Whitley gloomily.
Not exactly, said Martha. I turned to her with a shiver of dread. It's time you guys learned the truth.
What are you talking about? Asked Whitley.
Martha cleared her throat.
The Neverworld is more complex than you think. I mean, none of you have noticed anything strange?
Oh, no, this is all perfectly routine, said Kipling, smiling.
Strange things like what? I asked. Unusual disruptions. Magnetism. Instability.
Instantly, I thought of the mold, the peeling wallpaper, the tumbling trees, the collapsing shelves, the exploding snow globes, that black ink soaking through all the case files. Martha appeared to know what it was, what it meant. She was fumbling in her heavy black bag, pulling out a small black notebook. I recognized it. It was the one I'd spotted her carrying in the early days of the Neverworld, when she stopped to hastily scribble in the pages before moving on.
Sighting, 6:39 p.m., she read. One mysterious, purple-feathered owl perched atop a maple tree, unknown species. She turned the page. Overheard. Variety of 80s songs by The Cure in every passing car and every surrounding house.
Martha closed the notebook, surveying us.
Remember what the keeper said.
Imagine if each of your minds was placed inside a blender and that blender turned on high. The resulting smoothie is this moment.
Okay, said Whitley, nervous.
He was talking about the physics of the Neverworld. I'm very excited to tell you that it's based in part on J.C. Gossamer Madwick's groundbreaking masterpiece. And it's my fault.
What are you talking about? Asked Cannon.
I wrote a 200-page thesis on the novel. I tracked down every rare book about it, every obscure blog. I interviewed professors, experts, and scientists. I even went to visit Madwick's daughter on Bello Costa Island in the Florida Keys, rowing out to this tiny falling-down beach house in a remote cove swarming with alligators. She let me inspect Madwick's notebooks, which have never been seen by anyone outside the family, not even the people at Harvard who've been bullying her to donate them to their archives. I read all 11 notebooks, translating them from Luro script, the language Madwick made up.
She stopped her mad outpouring of words to take a deep breath.
I realized she was talking about The Bend, the fantasy novel she'd been obsessed with. The one no one had ever heard of except her and a bunch of geeky fanboys on the internet. My preoccupation with the book made it our reality. I lived it, breathed it. Now it's in the Neverworld.
But what does that mean, child?
Kipling asked, faint shrillness in his voice.
We're all about to float out into outer space, become androids?
Martha tilted her head and grinned, the lenses in her glasses flashing in the light. My heart plunged. Whatever she was about to tell us, I knew I couldn't trust it. I also knew that in this world stuck on repeat, everything we knew was about to change. Chapter 16.
Well, for one thing, Martha said excitedly. It means rather than waking up at Wincroft, we can wake up anywhere in the past, present, or future.
And how do we do that? Asked Cannon.
We climb out the unlatched window. We could only stare, baffled. She sighed.
Right. Okay, I got way ahead of myself.
She took another impatient breath.
Lesson 1. J.C. Gossamer Madwick was a science fiction writer. He wrote just one book called The Dark House at Elsewhere Bend. The Bend, for short. It's this amazing adventure story in an alternative world, different from anything you've ever read. It was never published, just photocopied over and over again, bound using a hole puncher and garbage bag zip ties, passed hand to hand by anonymous travelers, student backpackers, and disaffected youths in hostels. The thing you have to do once you finish The Bend? You sign the dedication page and leave it for the next lucky person on a park bench, bunk bed, airplane seat, or train compartment. For the longest time, the only copies to be found were in ancient bookshops and on eBay, some with hundreds of thousands of signatures. The ones with famous names of the readers, like Marilyn Monroe and Leonard Bernstein and Frank Sinatra, they went for as much as $4,000-$5,000. Now, it's an official cult classic, steadily in print, and even random people like ESS Burt have copies. To my surprise, Martha raced over to the shelves and pulled out a hulking silver hardback book. Returning to the couches, she handed it to me. The cover featured a collage of bird cages, steam trains, men and women wearing top hats, masquerade masks straight out of Victorian England. The Dark House of Elsewhere Bend by J.C. Gossamer Madwick. The legendary cult saga of future pasts, present mysteries, and undying love at the end of the world. I flipped to the back flap and stared down at the author photo. It was grainy and black and white. In a rumpled suit, Madwick was a man few would look twice at. Hound dog face, extravagant ears, an apologetic slouch suggesting he was more comfortable ducking out of a room than entering one. Jeremiah Chester Gossamer Madwick, December 2, 1891 to March 18, 1944, was an American novelist from Key West, Florida. His only work, the posthumously published The Dark House of Elsewhere Bend, won the Gilmer Hecht Prize for Fantasy in 1968. For 37 years, he worked as a bus driver for the Key West Transit Office, driving passengers to and from Stock Island by day, and writing his 1,397-page masterpiece by hand on hotel notepads by night. At age 53, he was found dead in the doorway of Hasty Retreat Saloon, a harmonica, a tin of tobacco, and the final paragraph of his novel in his pocket. "Madwick died penniless and unknown," Martha said. "Now he's considered one of the greatest fantasy writers who ever lived. Harvard has an entire class about him, Hobos, Strangers, and Vagabonds, the literature of Madwick. He even has a cult following in the real-life physics community due to his theory of time." She paused to hastily draw something in her notebook. It was a sketch of a train. "Which brings me to lesson two," she said. "Time travel. Madwick viewed time not as linear or an arrow or even a fabric like Einstein. He saw it as a locomotive. To time travel in Elsewhere Bend, you climb out the window of your speeding train compartment and scale onto the roof like a bandit in an old western. Then you carefully move toward the front of the train, the future, or the back of the train, the past. It's vital not to move too quickly in either direction because that will cause instability. Like the train can jump the tracks or crash, or separate compartments, or veer suddenly onto a wrong track heading clear in the opposite direction." Shuddering in apparent horror at the thought of such a scenario, Martha took a deep breath and tucked her hair behind her ears. "In the event of such disasters, you, the time traveler, are doomed. Because you'll never be able to get your train back running on the original track, much less on time, much less climb back to the compartment in which you began. Although technically you can live the rest of your life in the past or future, the carriage where you were born, the original present, is where you belong. Always. That's where life will be the smoothest journey for you, where things work out and love lasts. A life lived at any other time will be restless, rough, ill-fated. You can visit the past and the future, but you can't stay there. Not if you want any chance at happiness." "What does this have to do with the Neverworld?" asked Cannon, uneasy. "We want to interrogate Jim's parents? I believe we can. We just have to choose a day in the close past or the future where we can reach them in the 11.2 hours of the wake. Then we find the open window in our train and climb out. And this open window..." She nibbled her fingernail. "It's somewhere here. I don't know where yet, but it's a collision of life and death. It tends to be suicidal. In The Bend, the protagonist uncovers it by accident in Chapter 1 when he tries to commit suicide. And obviously, none of us has ever committed suicide." I shook my head. So did Whitley, Cannon, and Kipling. "So that rules that out," Martha said gloomily. "We'll have to locate the open window by some other means. Which brings me to lesson three." She cleared her throat. "The Neverworld was created not only by me, but by each of you. My biggest contribution is Madwick's Dark House at Elsewhere Bend. But what about you? The closer you study the Neverworld, the more of yourself you'll find. Your darkest secrets, your worst nightmares, your fears and dreams, the embarrassing thing you never want anyone to learn, it's all here, buried, if you look close enough." An uneasy chill inched down my spine. There was something threatening in the way she announced this. The others looked uncomfortable, too. Whitley sat on the couch, motionless. Kipling looked pale. Cannon stared her down, completely absorbed. Martha surveyed her notebook with a faint smile. "Kipling," she cleared her throat. "I meant to ask you." She held up a page where she'd drawn a red wasp. "The scarlet-bodied wasp moth, native to Louisiana. I've spotted three at Wincroft. Two crawled out of the attic upstairs.
another from a radiator. They shouldn't exist this far north. Do you recognize it?
How did you... blurted Kipling.
He chuckled nervously.
Mama Gria used to catch them in mason jars, kept them all around the house. Pit fiends, she called them. Said the sting was lethal and she'd put them on me while I slept if I didn't sit still during church.
Martha nodded blankly, unsurprised. She turned the page.
Canon, surely you've noticed all the Japanese larch?
He sat up, nervous.
The what?
The Japanese larch and silver birch trees growing around Wincroft. If you look closer, they're dead. A bunch of tall, spindly black tree trunks sticking out of the ground. Those trees aren't native to Rhode Island. They're indigenous to the Chubu and Kanto regions of Japan. If you go up to one and dig down about 6 inches, chalky blue water pools everywhere.
She beamed. You know what I'm getting at?
Cannon only stared.
Blue pond? She suggested. Cannon's birdcage? The bug you discovered in Apple's OS 10 operating system sophomore year? The accidental combination of keystrokes that crashes your hard drive, delivering the photo of Blue Pond wallpaper to your screen? The photograph is an almost surreal picture of a bright blue lake, dead snow-tipped trees growing right out of it.
He was confounded.
Okay, what about it?
That photo is embedded in the Neverworld's landscape. Everywhere. Cannon said nothing, only slipped to his feet, crossed the library to the window, stared out.
Then there's Whitley, Martha went on officially. There's a volatility in the Neverworld's weather because of you.
Me? Said Whit. Gale force winds, constant rain, thunder, lightning. It's your temper.
Whitley glared at her.
The night we went back to Darrow, Martha went on, how we got chased by the police. I watched wind overturn every car in the parking lot.
It was because of your confession about being the White Rabbit.
Whitley huffed in apparent disagreement, but her eyes flitted worriedly to the windows.
These details go for all of us, Martha went on. The closer we get to the truth, the root of who we are, the more unstable this world will become. Which brings me to Beatrice. She turned to me, her expression stony. My heart began to pound. I have no clue. Everyone frowned at her, and then at me.
Your contribution is here, somewhere, but I haven't figured it out yet.
I swallowed. What was Martha attempting to do? Intimidate me? Scare me? If so, it was working. She sighed.
One thing I do know is that if we try changing the wake, we have to stick together.
Why is that? Asked Cannon.
We don't know how we're going to react. The past hooks you like a drug. The future jolts you like an electric chair. Reliving beautiful memories can be just as devastating as reliving the terrible ones. They're addictive. Given that time travel in the Bend is so dangerous, and that inside the Neverworld there are elements we can't anticipate, the things you are each contributing, we have no idea what will happen if we even attempt this.
She shook her head. Her voice trembling with so much emotion, she reminded me of an evangelical minister on a public access channel lecturing a rapt congregation about the end of the world.
It could be a complete disaster. We could accidentally end up in different train compartments on different trains speeding in different directions. That means it'll be impossible to ever make it back here. To Wincroft. Together. To vote. Then we really will be trapped here forever.
The rest of us eyed each other in alarm.
No one spoke.
I gazed down at the hulking book on my lap. I couldn't breathe.
What was she up to?
Was Martha actually trying to help us? Or was this new revelation only the meticulous and conniving arrangement of her